Pawns of Chaos by Brian Craig. Narrated by a Border Prince. Chapter 5. Hysilla led Dathan directly towards the setting sun, which grew redder in colour as it approached the flat horizon. It seemed to grow in size as it touched the rim of the plain, and its face was no longer so bright that it was impossible to look at it for more than a fraction of a second. It was possible to see now that the sun's face was neither still nor featureless, that the entire sphere was perpetually turbulent, seething like a cauldron. As the colour of the sky darkened from a soft violet to deep purple, it began to reveal the movements that were ordinarily cloaked by brilliance. Even though the stars had hardly begun to shine, the sky began to shimmer like the surface of an oily pool. The entire universe was restless, Dathan thought. That was the truth of the matter. It surely could not be alive, any more than the wind-stirred air on the desert sands were alive. But neither was it quiet. It could no more settle into silence and stillness than a baby racked by hunger and fear. Perhaps the stars themselves had their hungers, and the void between them its fears. "We should stop to rest," he said to Hysilla, when he saw that she was utterly exhausted. But she would not listen. The strangeness that intimidated people had taken hold of her, and even Dathan felt unease stirring the depths of his being. "If we stop here, we'll never get up again," Hysilla said brusquely. "We need to keep going while the light lasts. We need to reach Elvenor, and if we can, to find shelter. And if we can't, we must find water." That was far more easily said than done. The plain was not a desert like the Amber Wastes. Grasses grew here in profusion, and bushes of many different sorts. But the rainfall was sporadic, and this was the dry season. There were herds of wild horses and pigs in the wasteland, although Pater Sultana had told them that there had been no such creatures in the world before the first humans came, as well as gazelles and loxodonts, but they were few and far between. The village men often mounted hunting expeditions in the autumn, and the game they sought was just about abundant enough to ensure that they rarely came home empty-handed. But as Dathan scanned the terrain laid out before him, he could not see a single animal of any kind. There must be water holes somewhere, and common sense suggested that they ought to reveal themselves by imparting a lusher complexion to the surrounding vegetation. But the plain's colours made a mockery of the other meaning of the word plain. They were far too confusing to permit easy discrimination. The further Dathan and Hysilla had come from the burning forest, the more confusing the plant life had become. The fields planted by the villagers were green, and so were most of the plants that grew wild in their vicinity. Judai trees, which had been in the world long before the first humans came, 1,000 generations ago, were not so very different from the trees that grew in the neighbouring orchards. Dathan realised now, though, that the village might have been built where it was precisely because the location seemed uncommonly hospitable, and that the plain across which he and Hysilla were now trudging was devoid of permanent human habitation precisely because it was not. Here, there was as much red and purple foliage as green, and a good deal of ochreous yellow. The fruits on the bushes, which seemed so tempting to Dathan because he was hungry as well as desperately thirsty, even though they were past ripeness and shriveling on the bough, were white and red and black and glorious sky purple. He had been taught to avoid them, not so much because all of them were bitter and a few frankly poisonous, but because hardly any of them had much nutritional value to human beings. Some cautionary folk tales of his people told of children lost on the plain, who filled their stomachs time and time again with tempting produce, and starved to death, even with their bellies crammed. Gazelles and loxodonts, not to mention countless smaller creatures, grew fit and fat on such produce, but the horses and pigs that had escaped human control in the distant past had to be more discriminating. Even so, Dathan thought, the fact that some animals could live out here proved that humans could too, if they could only develop similar powers of discrimination. The most striking thing of all about the vegetation of the plain was not so much its colour as its variety. It was not uncommon to see bushes, which supported leaves of a dozen different shapes, and flowers of a dozen different conformations. The crops the villagers grew were stubborn in that regard. Each one clung to a single basic pattern, with only a few exceptions. The plants that had developed here enjoyed a remarkable freedom of expression within and between generations. They seemed far more susceptible to disease, deformation, and death, but they compensated for that sensitivity with exuberance. "We could pick fruits and crush them, then throw away the pulp and drink the moisture," Dathan suggested, as the last thin slice of the sun's disk slipped out of sight and left them to twilight. The western horizon was flat, save for a ragged semicircular shadow just to the south of the point at which the sun had gone down. The shape was suggestive of an artificial structure, but there seemed to be vegetation of some sort growing on top of it, so it was probably just an oddly shaped hill. We need water far purer than that, Icelia told him, after a few moments' thought. Even if there was no poisons dissolved in it, there'd be other substances which our body would have to excrete. It would be like drinking seawater. Dayford wondered how she could possibly know this. She wasn't talking like a village child anymore. She was talking like someone to whom the secrets had been revealed by some mysterious inner process. Like Dayfin, Hycelia had never seen the sea, and probably never would. So how did she know what drinking seawater would be like? And why was she using a word like excrete? Everyone liked to hear stories of piracy and adventure in far-flung lands, of course, and of desperate castaways marooned on desert islands. But Hycelia seemed to be speaking with an authority derived from a very different source. Dathan was beginning to understand why people sometimes took a step back when Hycelia was like this, and he had never known her be like it for this long. Would she ever return to her true self, he wondered, or had she been changed forever by the arrival of the Imperium? We'll never find pure water, Dathan said bleakly. He wished that he had not breathed in so much smoke when the Judai forest caught fire. Surely he would not feel as thirsty as he did if his throat had not been scorched. Yes, we will, Hycelia told him, as she marched relentlessly towards the place where the sun had disappeared. What's the point, anyway? Dathan demanded. Everyone we ever knew is dead, and our home is gone. Where are we going? Where is there to go? There's an army out here somewhere, she told him. An army gathered to fight the invaders. Pity they weren't in the village, Dathan said hoarsely. They could have fought them today. I doubt that this was the only place where the soldiers crossed the wasteland. Most travellers avoid the amber wastes. Even if they have camels, they usually go the long way round to the north, or the even longer way to the south. These men had trucks that could move much faster than a camel train, but we were unlucky, even so. Unlucky? We're supposed to be the ones with magic on our side. We have sorcerers and wise dreamers, and they don't. Why weren't we warned? It wasn't intended to be a personal attack, but Hycelia could hardly help but take it personally. She was the village's most favoured child, said by Pater Sultana to have been touched by the true god. I see so much in my dreams, she said flatly, but none of it clearly. Even the greatest sorcerer in the world can be lost in confusion or betrayal by illusion. Dathan knew that she was quoting Pater Sultana. So much for the gift of further sight, Dathan muttered, or the honesty of the true god. You're wrong to mock, Hycelia told him, and foolish to blaspheme. Her voice was oddly intense. She wasn't quoting Pater Sultana any longer, but Dathan had the impression that her words weren't her own. At least, not entirely. The reason the wisest dreams are so confused, Hycelia went on, is that the future is not yet made. It exists at present, as a near infinite set of possibilities whose likelihood changes with every second that ticks away. The mere fact of looking into the sea of possibility affects the likelihood, so everything we glimpse changes as we try to focus on it, because we've glimpsed it and because we're trying to focus on it. If we saw it any other way, the god which grants us sight would be lying. Dathan decided that he had liked Hycelia better when she was just a girl, untouched by an outside force. It was only to be expected that wise dreamers would become wiser, but this was definitely scary. You might think that my talent is too uncertain to be useful, she continued, as if she was still trying, wonderingly, to make sense of what she was saying. But imagine the alternative. Imagine looking into the future and seeing it all mapped out, fixed and definite, perfectly ordered and unaltered. What benefit could be gained from such insight as that? It would only tell us that we were utterly helpless to change anything, utterly impotent to make anything of ourselves other than what's already made. Aren't we? Dathan thought. But Hycelia was lost in her own private wilderness and wouldn't have heard him even if he had spoken the words aloud. It would tell us that we're machines, Hycelia said, with an odd edge to her voice which suggested she was beginning to frighten herself, or puppets acting out a ritual we can neither change nor understand. What kind of mind could such a seer have? What kind of thoughts and feelings could she have? Her experience would be pure horror, a sensation of absolute and inescapable entrapment. That's what the enemy want to make of the future, Dathan, and of the whole of existence. They want to bring order to the world. Well, I'm glad that when I dream wisely, I see confusion. If I couldn't see confusion, I wouldn't be free, and I wouldn't be human, and the god whose gifts I bear would be the most monstrous tyrant imaginable. She didn't sound at all glad. She sounded as if she felt that she ought to be, but couldn't quite find the courage. In her own way, Dathan thought, she must be as frightened as he was, but the fact that her way was so different from his was frightening in itself. So much Dathan fought for being free, so much for being human. As dusk fell, though, they found their guide. While the sun shone, they had seen birds of several kinds fluttering about the branches of bushes or darting from one to another. But now the dark was gathering, the birds were gathering too, into unexpectedly huge flocks, which took to the air in mass, wheeling this way and that as they piped their various calls and then set off for their roosts. "There," Hycelia said, her finger following the direction taken by one of the flocks, some way to the north of their westward course. "That's where we'll find water. It's out of our way, but I don't think we can reach Elvenor tonight. We'd do better to make the detour." "Let's hope it's not far," Dathan said, but he swiftly realised that if the water had been too far distant, they would not have been able to see the birds descend. He and Hycelia actually contrived to increase their pace in spite of their fatigue, as urgency spurred them on. As the night became absolute, the two fugitives arrived at the rim of a saucer-shaped depression. In the middle of the depression was a pool surrounded by rushes and chimerical flowering plants. They were far stranger than any that Dathan had ever seen before. There was a saying in the village which bade children beware of the gardens of the god. Its meaning had never been clear to Dathan, but as soon as he saw that bizarre array of flowers, he thought he understood what kind of garden the god of Gul-Zakandra might maintain. Alas, he could not excise due caution. The need to drink overrode all other considerations. He forced his way through a clump of rushes and threw himself down on the edge of the water, scooping up handfuls and filling his avid mouth. All around him, the birds were chattering, but even as he drank, their conversation ceased. When he had had enough, he made no attempt to get up, but simply rolled onto his back and looked upwards at the sky. The stars were out in force now, as relentless as ever. They were shifting this way and that, apparently at random, changing colour very slightly as the quality of their light altered. Dathan wondered whether they were as relentless now as they had been when he was a little child. Everyone said that they had become quieter, that throughout his lifetime they had been growing steadily less irritable. But Dathan could not tell. He could not remember a time when the movement of the stars had been noticeably more vigorous. Was it possible, he wondered, that it was only anxiety that made his elders think that the stars might be settling down? The last time the stars had stood still, it was said, the Imperium had fallen out of the sky, a dire punishment meted out onto the world. Were they to stand still again, it was said, then the Imperium would come again. Today, of course, the Imperium had come, but when Pater Sultana was at his scariest, he would sometimes speak of an Imperium beyond the world's Imperium, a true Imperium, vaster than anyone could imagine. The world's Imperium could be fought, Pater Sultana had always assured him, although Dathan was no longer able to believe it. But the true Imperium was irresistible. If the god of Gul-Zakandra were ever displeased with the prayers and sacrifices offered by his people, Pater Sultana had prophesied, while his eyes had grown sulphurous and terrible, then the god would merely rest his hand. The stars would stand still in the heavens, and death would rain down from the sky. According to Pater Sultana, in his quieter and gentler moments, the stars did not really move at all, any more than the sun moved around the world. The sun only appeared to move across the sky because the world was turning, and the stars only appeared to be restless because the world was in the grip of a curious kind of storm. A storm whose wind stirred the fundamental fabric of space, making waves in the void. Even so, death could descend from the sky like a storm of hail if the people of Gul-Zakandra were ungenerous in their sacrifices and unenthusiastic in their prayers. All three moons had risen now, and all of them were full. Dathan had seen all three of them full at the same time on two previous occasions, but they had been far more widely distributed about the sky. He did not think that he had ever seen them so close together, even as crescents. By the time they reached their zenith, he judged, they would be even closer, arranged in a tight tangle, whose sides were of equal length. "Dathan!" Hycelia screamed so loudly that he was bolt upright. It was as well that he did. He heard the sound of jaws snapping shut so close that a little gust of foul breath stirred the hairs in the back of his neck. Dathan didn't waste time looking around. He dived away from the poolside, sprawling among the rushes. By the time he did turn around, there was nothing to be seen on the pool's surface but a vast circle of spreading ripples. Hycelia's silhouette loomed above him, blotting out a few of the stars. He couldn't see the hand that she was extending to him, but he knew it was there. He took it, and Hycelia helped him up. There was something in her touch that made him quiver, but he was grateful nonetheless. "What was it?" he asked. "Nothing I have a name for," she told him. It had a long neck and a head like a snake's, but it seemed to have a big body submerged below the surface. I don't think it will come out of the water, and it'll probably move sluggishly if it did, but we'd better leave a wide margin just in case. Dathan was glad to observe that Hycilia sounded more like herself now. There's a place, 40 or 50 paces that way, where we can lie down, she added. The ground's not bare, but the grass isn't too tall or spiky, and we can make mattresses of a sort by cutting rushes. You have a knife, I suppose. Only a little one, Dathan told her, remembering how dreadfully inadequate it had seemed when he had needed a weapon. It proved, however, to be quite adequate to the task of cutting rushes once he had broken the rigid stems. We should eat something, Dathan told Hycilia, when they had made a makeshift bed on which to lie. Even if it isn't real food, it'll stop us feeling hungry. No, she said. The risk's too great. We'll find something tomorrow when we're on the move again. She knew the village saying as well as he did, and she must have jumped to the same conclusion about the nature of this place as he had. She was supposed to be a favourite of the true god, but even she didn't dare to eat the fruits of his garden. Dathan was sure that his hunger would keep him awake, and not at all sure that he wanted to sleep, given that the pool was bound to attract predators from the plain, as well as those that lurked beneath its placid surface. He had underestimated the extent of his exhaustion, though. Almost as soon as he laid his head down, he fell into a shallow sleep, as restless as the stars, and full of inconvenient dreams. Dathan had never shown the slightest sign of magical ability. Like every other village child, he had dutifully reported his dreams to Pater Sultana almost as soon as he learned to speak, and he still remembered how disappointed he had been to have them rejected as items of little interest. Hycilia's reported dreams had not sounded any different to his untutored ear, and he had been jealous when Pater Sultana began taking a greater interest in them. Now Dathan dreamed of ships in space, ships shaped like detached fingers, or fabulous eyeballs, or chicken bones, but made of polished metal. He dreamed of whole flocks of ships, wheeling this way and that in unison, shooting forth fire that burned whole worlds and sent spears of lightning into the hearts of the gods themselves. But he knew all the while that this could not be wise dreaming. It was only a froth of imagination born of horror, fed by fear, and made grotesque by the feverish heat of his blood. Hycilia was even more restless than he, and Dathan was very conscious of the fact that she never fell still beside him. She was always turning from one side to the other, drawing her knees up to her belly at one moment and stretching her legs as straight as she could at the next. She was muttering too, although he could not make out what she was saying to herself, and the intermittent murmur wove itself into Dathan's own dreams as the voice of some hidden companion who was desperate to be understood but could not communicate its warnings. The voice became ever more frustrated as the failure continued. Dathan knew that it was not really Hycilia's voice. It was the voice that had merged with hers when she made her long speech about wise dreaming, the voice of something strange and scary. Dathan wasn't at all sure that he wanted to listen to that voice, whether Hycilia were awake or asleep, but he couldn't stop himself. Eventually, Dathan began to think that he could make sense of at least a few of the words whispered into his ear, but even when he came to that conclusion, he couldn't decide whether it was the voice itself that was becoming clearer, or whether his own dream was imposing a kind of clarity upon it. Alas, much of what he discerned seemed to consist of the names of people and things, some of which were familiar, and some of which were not. Gavlon was the name most frequently repeated, that one he knew. Another, almost as frequent, seemed to be Sathorel, that one he had never heard before. Cannock he knew, Fulbrer he did not, nor Ecclesiarchy, nor Orc, nor Astronomicon. The one name he did not hear, no matter how hard he tried, was Dathan. In the end, although the murmurous voices never died away, Dathan's attention was distracted by something far more disturbing, a great red-rimmed eye that seemed to fill his field of dream vision, as if it were the eye of the sky itself. The iris of the eye was a thin rim of pink around a huge black hole, which poured forth a kind of light like one that Dathan had never seen with his waking eyes, light which withered everything it touched, the light of instantaneous decay. That light seemed to be everywhere, the glare of the eye unavoidable. No matter how much confusion you see when you dream, his dream self told Hycilia, although she was not present in his dream as a listener, you cannot ever be free. And no matter what aspects of the future remain unmade and uncertain, the ultimate fate of everything is fleeting decay and absolute annihilation. Nothing endures and nothing can, and no matter what power the Imperium of Mankind may obtain and use, it is doomed to fall apart and vanish within a single moment in the great forever of universal time. He knew, though, that it was only a foolish dream. Dathan had never been touched, so far as he knew, by the god of his people. He had neither wisdom nor magic of his own, and he could not reasonably expect that Hycilia's whispering voice might transform the essence of his soul. no matter how much he loved her.